proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Wow. Gold is exploding. Oil is exploding. The dollar is falling like crazy in the second hour of our... Oh, and bankruptcies are up record highs, hitting levels we haven't seen since the Great Depression. Arms are resetting. Serious, I would say, concerning, major front page story in the Financial Times in the UK about the U.S. economy. In the second hour of our program, Aaron Varhola, bankruptcy attorney, is going to be with us talking about what can individuals do to protect themselves against economic hard times. And we're going to be talking largely about what's going on with the overall economy. In our third hour, Dennis Kucinich is going to join us, assuming all, you know, everything works out. Things sometimes don't with schedules of people who are in Congress. But we're scheduled to have Dennis on at the beginning of our third hour to talk about his attempt yesterday to impeach Dick Cheney or to begin the process and where that is and whether he shows up or not. We will be discussing that and the politics of everything else that's going on in the world and that and a lot more. Right now, Terrence Jeffrey is with us. He's with the Cybercast News, CNSNews.com, the Cybercast News service. Used to be the conservative news service. And Terrence, editor-in-chief, in fact, at Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. Terrence, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
There is a, and this was in the news a week or so ago in a big way, but it's coming back now because the Portland, Maine School Board, I'm broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, on the other side of the country, but the Portland, Maine School Board had, by 7-2, as I recall, passed a resolution allowing their in-house nurse program, doctor, their medical program, which requires a parent's permission to participate in, to pass out birth control pills to middle school kids, which is basically, what, 13 to 16 years old, 12 to 15 years old in that neighborhood. And you've written about this and over at CNSNews.com, and you have some concerns about it, and there's a Christian group, the Christian Civil League of Maine, that's going after the Maine Attorney General. Tell us about this.
Well, yeah, the King Middle School in Portland, Maine, actually enrolls, it's 6th through 8th grade, and there are children in that school from 11 to 15 years old. And if their parents generically approve of them using the in-school health clinic, what the Portland Schools Committee decided a few weeks ago was that the clinic would be allowed to provide prescription birth control pills and patches to those kids without notifying their parents down to 11 years of age. And now the American Center for Law and Justice, which is a nonprofit law firm that was started by Pat Robertson, is threatening to sue the city on behalf of some Portland residents who have complained to them about it if they don't rescind this policy on the basis of this being a violation of the rights of the parents who have a right to know about prescription drugs being given to their children, particularly drugs that may facilitate sexual activity. And secondly, because the actual statute in Maine, the law in Maine says that it is illegal for anybody 13 years or under to engage in sexual activity of any kind with anybody, including another 13-year-old, and that people in something like a health clinic have a duty under the law to report any evidence of activity like that. So it seems as if, you know, if you accept the idea that prescribing birth control pills or patches is prima facie evidence that there might be sexual activity going on, it seems like this school committee is basically becoming complicit with a violation of law that is designed to protect children from sexual abuse.
Okay, well, this raises a couple of interesting questions. First of all, Middle King School is on the record as saying the five sexually active students that they've identified are all either 14 or 15 years old, so that's legal sex.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Secondly, Douglas Gardner, the director of the Department of Health, and I'm reading this from your news release, by the
right.
way, the director of Portland, Maine's Department of Health and Human Services has said they are going to report kids under 13 and under who say that they're having sex. They're going to report them to the police.
Good.
Which raises the question, if those kids are having, you know, if a child under 13 is having sex, now they no longer have anybody that they can talk to about it, which frankly I think is unwise. But B, how long should a 13-year-old who has sex with another 13-year-old be put in prison?
How long should they be put in prison?
Right. Do you think that they should get the five years that the statute requires?
I'd have to know the specific case. You know, I'm not going to.
Well, if you want them to report it to the police, and you want to force the law in here, I mean, how long should they be go to jail?
Well, let me answer your question. Does the state have an interest in making sexual activity among 11, 12, and 13 year olds illegal? Absolutely, without question.
Great. Then how long should they go to prison?
Well, then wait a minute. Now, so then the second question is, what if I were actually writing the statute would be the ideal punishment for a 12-year-old who is discovered to be violating the law and engaging in sexual activity? I don't necessarily think that person should go to jail. Should there be some way to prohibit it and prevent it in law? Yes. Do the parents have a right to know? Yes. Does the school have a right to come in and give a drug to that child without the parent's knowledge? No.
Okay, well, the two provisions that we have in criminal law, because you're talking about criminal activity.
Right.
The two provisions that we have in criminal law tend to be imprisonment or fines.
Mm-hmm.
So if it sounds to me like you're saying that you don't think that that one of these kids who breaks the law should go to the juvenile detention facility for a couple of years, or are you saying that they should?
You know what? I tell you what. I can't say that. Look, if you have an 11-year-old daughter and your 11-year-old daughter is in a middle school, and there is a 13-year-old boy in that middle school who takes her out, gets her drunk, and then engages in sexual activity with her, and when this is discovered and it's brought to court and the facts are tried, and it was discovered that this kid's done this 20 times to 20 different girls, do I think that kid ought not to be put in a juvenile detention facility? If I were the judge, I'd have to sit there in the court and decide. Do I think it might be a just punishment? Absolutely, Tom.
Well, you're giving the most extreme example, and one with which I probably would not disagree.
Okay,
if you've got a 13-year-old sexual predator, there's already laws on the books to deal with that. But I would argue that that's not consensual sex. When you have, particularly a child, but even
she willingly got drunk. She willingly went with him.
No,
engaged in sex with him.
Sorry, it's not. But here's the question: if you've got, you know, two 13-year-olds who are simply having consensual sex, and you want it, and it is illegal, and you want it reported to the police really only have one weapon. They only have one tool, and that's jail.
Well, no,
and the courts have a second weapon, and that is fines.
When someone goes to jail is not determined by the police. But secondly, you just
why not refer them to medical counseling? Why not refer them to psychiatric services?
Those are also possible. Good.
Why not refer them to social services? Well, no, none of those are options if you criminalize.
No, that's not true. You and I agree. When you asked me at first, I said I'd have to know the individual case, and I'm not the judge. I'm not sitting there in the court. Now, I described for you a case in which you agreed that with me that maybe in that case you would put that kid in the juvenile detention center. If I were the judge, given other circumstances and other cases, I might say you have to go to this counseling service. You might have to do this. But under no circumstance would I say it's legal for an 11, 12, or 13-year-old kid to have sex because the state does, in fact, have an interest in preventing that activity.
Okay, so what we're agreeing on, I guess, is that there's a gray area here. I'm saying saying this with some experience. For 5 years, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village, for severely emotionally disturbed children. And virtually all of them who came through that program, and I'm still on the board of directors here 25 years later, virtually all the children who came through that program had, most of them have been sexually abused. Many of them have been sexually active. And I'm telling you, when those kids got tied up in the criminal justice system, it destroyed their lives. When they got tied up in the social services system, maybe very often it saved their lives. And there's a very important distinction here. But there's a second question, because we only have about a minute left,
yeah,
Terrence.
Sure.
You're also arguing, and Pat Robertson is also arguing, against democracy and local control. If the local community says, yes, we have a problem with teenage pregnancy, and we want the only solution that we've been able to come up with successfully so far is to pass out birth control pills, who are you to tell the local community that they can't do what they want to do?
For the same exact reason that the federal government was able to tell the people of Birmingham in 1963 that it was flat out wrong for them to segregate their public schools and send blacks to inferior schools. There are God-given rights that need to be defended against even majoritarian rule, and the right of a parent to raise his child up to be a good and decent person may not be violated by any public school anywhere, and the ACLJ is doing excellent work to try and protect parents who don't want their children expose this abusive practice by the Portland public
school. So this is where this is one of the areas where you would say democracy, you know, out the window.
This is
like the majority of Americans wanted slavery. We had slavery. The majority of Americans said we should have segregation. The government stepped in against that, and that was the right thing.
The majority did not justify taking away someone's rights or committing an immoral act.
And local communities should not have local control over how they treat
not
the kids.
Not do something wrong. Portland, Maine cannot reinstitute slavery.
Okay.
Nor may they give birth control to an 11-year-old child without parental permission.
All righty. CNSNews.com. Terrence Jeffrey. Thanks, Terrence.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
So, Pat Robertson is going to sue the city of Portland, Maine. Pat Robertson also today endorsing Rudy Giuliani. Pat Robertson, not a believer in democracy and local control, apparently. A believer in, well, that his worldview should dominate. And that if kids are sexually active, throw them in jail, apparently. Let's criminalize the whole thing. Pat also says God talks to him. And this, by the way, in January of 2005, Pat had a conversation with God. He reported about it on his 700 Club. Pat Robertson, by the way, a billionaire with a B, very wealthy man, as a consequence of his Christian broadcasting activities over the years. And so, of course, he's very concerned about not having to pay Social Security taxes and income taxes. So God had some reassuring words for him.
But what I heard was that Bush is now positioned to have victory after victory, and that his second term is going to be one of triumph, which is pretty strong stuff.
Wow.
But that he'll have Social Security reform passed, that he'll have tax reform passed. I will remove judges from the Supreme Court quickly.
Whoa. So Pat Robertson telling us that God told him he's going to kill some Supreme Court justices. Apparently one bit the dust, but I don't know if it was God that did it. And that Bush was going to do away with Social Security and cut taxes. And I haven't seen that happen since Bush. So I don't know. Pat, also some very strong thoughts on Muslims.
It's amazing how the Muslims deal with history and the truth with violence. They don't understand what reason dialogue is.
Yeah, ever heard of the Crusades, Pat? Well, and in fact, speaking of the Crusades, here's a guy who says that Muslims don't understand what reason dialogue is. They only want to deal with people with violence. Well, okay, Pat, how would you deal with Hugo Chavez?
You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war. And I don't think any oil shipments will stop, but this man is a terrific...
Yeah, no oil shipments are going to stop. Don't worry about that. Just go ahead and assassinate him. But you're not at the head of a bloody, bloody religion, Pat. Somebody else is, right?
Who ever heard of such a bloody, bloody, brutal type of religion? But that's what it is. It is not a religion of peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, anyhow, this in the same vein, back to what's going on in Portland, Maine. First of all, I want to say, as the parent of three children, as somebody who's worked with kids for years, and as somebody who has been one, as I think we all have, this has got to be a really tough one for the Portland School Committee. I mean, this has got to be a really tough one. And here you have a local community dealing with the fact that in their middle school, and this is principally among 14- and 15-year-olds, this is not the 11-, 12-, and 13-year-olds that everybody's hysterical about. In fact, the five kids that they've identified who are sexually active are all 14 years or over, which is legal in Maine, by the way. But nonetheless, here you have this school board elected by, supported by, and answerable to the local parents making this decision, saying, okay, we don't know how else to deal with this. We've had a bunch of pregnancies in this school in the last couple of years, and they shouldn't have happened, and we're not sure what to do. Well, part of it might be that the Bush administration has been pushing abstinence-only sex education And, of course, the school systems, this is pretty much all they have available. Now we have this nonpartisan campaign, National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unwanted Pregnancy. They just did this huge study. And what they found was that abstinence programs are absolutely, totally ineffective at preventing teenage sexual activity or teenage pregnancy. On the other hand, the study, this is quoting from the study, comprehensive sex education programs have positive outcomes, including teenagers delaying the initiation of sex, reducing the frequency of sex, reducing the number of sexual partners, and increasing condom or contraceptive use. The bottom line, as they say, Douglas Kirby, senior researcher with ETR Associates, he says this basically refutes the myths propagated by the abstinence-only advocates. None of those myths, according to the study, were found to be accurate. Instead, he said, quoting, such programs improved teens' knowledge about the risk. This is not abstinence-only sex education, but comprehensive sex education. Comprehensive sex education programs improve teens' knowledge about the risks and consequences of pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases, and thus gave them greater confidence in their ability to say no to unwanted sex. So, arguably, going all the way back to Reagan, the campaign to take sex education, comprehensive sex education, out of our schools has led, along with the sexualization of our consumer society, right down to the fact, right down to the Fox News babes. I mean, it's the sexualization of our society is just, it's rampant. And it's being driven by the largest corporations in America. And very profitable, thank you very much. And you combine these things along with essentially banning comprehensive sex education, and what's the result? Kids having sex at a younger age, more pregnancies. Here's a school board trying in good faith to deal with it, and Pat Robertson wants to come in and tell them how to run the show, what they should be doing. I mean, what's wrong with this picture? Pat Robertson, who's calling for the assassination of other people and then calling other religions bloody. I'm boggled. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
There's no hallelujah, yes sir, no sir. Have it on a string and those words are spewing, yes sir, no sir. They don't mean a thing, but those wheels are rolling, yes sir, no sir. On that green machine.
34 minutes past the hour. Friday night, I'll be in Phoenix at the Harkins Theater, Friday afternoon, 3 to 5 p.m. You can get tickets. We'll be doing our show from Phoenix, in fact, on Friday. Get tickets at 1480kphx.com for that gig. That you do need tickets for that. On the 12th, on Monday night, I'll be in Philadelphia at the White Dog Cafe. Be sitting down for dinner at 6. Say hi to folks. 7:30, giving a talk on cracking the code, signing books. On the 13th at 7 p.m. at the Strand Bookstore, I'll be signing Cracking the Code, and my friend Richard Belzer is going to announce me and or introduce me and hang out and say hi. On the 14th in New York, Demos, and I think Mark Green is going to be there to introduce me. Network for Ideas and Actions will be talking about Cracking the Code. And on the 16th, Green 960 AM San Francisco is putting on a gig at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City from 3:30 to 6 p.m. You can get more information at green960.com. So check it out. We got a big week coming up. I'm going to be on the road all week. The ACLU reports the existence of a third secret torture memo authored by the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel in May of 2005. Looks like this one has even been withheld from Congress. So here we have the Department of Justice apparently breaking the law about breaking the law, oddly enough. Here in Oregon, and this was watched nationwide, the tobacco industry spent $12 million in this little tiny state of just a couple of million people, $12 million to defeat a measure that was essentially like the S-chip program that would have taxed tobacco to ensure most of the children in the state, to provide health insurance for most of the kids. And in fact, this is one of the yes on measure 50s. This is pointing out the tobacco industry's lies.
Big Tobacco is at it again, lying about Measure 50, the Healthy Kids Initiative. The Oregonian calls their ads utterly untrue, outright false. The truth? Measure 50 provides health care to 100,000 kids.
Yeah, and then it goes on from there. But anyhow, $12 million from the tobacco companies. It worked. So it's pretty mind-boggling. Other news of the day. We'll get to as we go through the program. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Ben in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call in about that last guy you had on there, about talking about the sexual rights of 11- and 12-year-olds and things of that sort.
Well, I'm not suggesting that 11- and 12-year-olds have sexual rights, but I am suggesting that, you know, putting them in jail is not the solution.
Right. And I agree with that. I mean, for example, my sister got caught stealing a pack of gum from a Walgreens, and she did get fined, and you know, but she didn't go to jail. But what they did do is they put her in a social program. In our family, we called it the good girl school for bad girls. And you know, she was forced to go there once a week or whatever, and you know, learn counseling and do that sort of thing. I think what we need is counseling programs and things of that sort to help these kids. I mean, they're obviously going through a tough time. I don't think locking everybody in jail is the right answer.
I absolutely agree. I don't think that this should be the province of the criminal justice system. And also, let me add to that, that to a certain extent, what we're talking about here is the barn door after the horse has already left the barn. We should be talking about preemptive sex education, comprehensive sex education, because all the studies show that when kids get comprehensive sex education at an age before they're sexually active, when they're 10, 11, 12 years old, then they are less likely to become sexually active at an early age. And in particular, girls are more likely to feel confident about saying no and have, you know, a rationale for saying no and an understanding and the empowerment of it. It's very straightforward. Ben, thanks a lot for your call and your thoughts. Jim in Los Angeles on K-Talk. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. But back when I was 13 years old, I got caught having sex by the boys' principal in junior high school.
Uh-oh.
And I was scared. But the thing was, you know, I talked to him, like, I think it was like 25 years later, and I asked him, how come you didn't say anything to my parents or, you know, punish me or send me to the police? And he said, that would be just a waste of time because it would be, you know, it wouldn't be constructive because had I done that, he probably would have been a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that helped a lot. And also, I also had, you know, learned about sex through sex education. So that helped a lot too. So that curtailed my, you know, unprotected events. So yeah, I mean, sending someone to, you know, to jail, prison or juvenile hall is not going to help, especially when they have sex, because it will just make them a lot worse. And I sat down and thought about it and I said, you know what? You know, if they did send me to jail or whatever, I'd probably come out and probably be a lot more worse.
Well, then you come out as worse than simply, you know, a kid who is sexually active. You come out as a kid who's been exposed to some really tough, really criminal elements, and perhaps, you know, I mean, I can tell you again from having run a facility for severely emotionally disturbed kids, several of whom came out of juvenile detention facilities are out of the state mental hospital, many of whom came out of foster homes. In fact, the first intake I ever did was a kid who had failed 32 foster placements. She was the daughter of her sister by her father. It was an absolute mess and had been abused in at least half the foster home she'd been in, which is not an, you know, and I don't mean to indict foster care, and I think foster care is a marvelous and wonderful thing, but it needs a lot of supervision. And I mean, it's like, we have a really messed up system in this country, and the solution isn't jails and prison. The solution is dealing with it at the level of education and treatment and counseling. Jim, thanks a lot. Well said. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. What's going on? I was upset. I want to talk to the guy who was there before, because those people, I just say, please silence, because they're spitting out stuff that's not even necessary.
Well, this is Pat Robertson. He, you know, this morning he endorsed Giuliani.
Oh,
you know? Yeah, it's, I mean, this is all about is Pat Robertson is going to sue this school district in Portland at the same time that he's endorsing Rudy Giuliani. Apparently, Rudy Giuliani doesn't believe in democracy either.
But Tom, the trippy thing about him, I say to please pay no attention to the man on the side. He's just a fool.
Yeah, okay.
He's just a fool. And because, first of all, from what I'm told, is that in order to get to God, you have to go through this guy we call Jesus, right?
Yeah.
He always says, God said. So he's a fool. Pay no attention to the clown on the sideline.
The Pat Robertson with
yeah.
God talking
Don't
to him.
Don't listen to him.
Yeah,
Don't.
Okay.
He's foolish.
Good advice, Brian. Thank you very much. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, listening on KLSD.
Hey, Tom. Listen, as a former OBGYN, I'm completely behind where you stand on this. I did have a question, though, and that is, how does the Portland, Maine folks get away from the practicing medicine without a license if they're having a nurse prescribing and dispensing birth control pills? That was a concern. You know, is that, did they write a special law to allow that?
Yes, it is legal what is being done. There are nurse practitioners in some states who can write prescriptions. In some states, nurses, certain types of nurses can write prescriptions. This may be done under a doctor's supervision. I'm not sure. I know that the parents have to sign off on it before the kids go into the program, and they're informed of all the possible medications or whatever that may be available to their children, and the fact that there's medical confidentiality for the child. And so the parents go into this, you know, with their eyes wide open. And frankly, I think that's really the only way to do it. I think it's the best way to do it. And
'cause the other issue that comes up is, you know, we're talking about teens. I had a hard enough time getting my teenage daughter to take a shower every day. Much less remember to take a pill every day. And,
right.
And how do you, you know, making sure that they know how to take this medicine.
I know.
And the fact that it's not for everybody. There are certain people that shouldn't take this. It is a drug.
Right.
It isn't medicine.
No, you're right. And these are very serious hormones. And this is not something that should be taken lightly. And birth control pills should not be passed out like candy. And I don't believe that they are. I'm believing that this is a small community where most of the people know each other. And I mean, this is a town of just, I think at the most a couple hundred thousand people. You know, I think we can safely assume that it's all being done legally, because that's not the basis against which it's being attacked. And the basis against which it's being attacked is that the local community shouldn't be able to determine their own rules. And I would be surprised. I would be astounded if the medical professionals involved with this, with the school health program, the school board, and the parents weren't doing this right and weren't doing it legally. I understand your position, Scott, and agree with it. And I from every news report that I've read, I live on the other side of the country, so this is no firsthand experience.
And for anyone else who's listening, this doesn't work by itself. Like you said, it has to be part of a broader program that includes sexual education, STD education, pregnancy education, all these things, and this would just be a part of that.
Yeah, very well said. Scott, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Adam in New York City. Hey, Adam.
Hey, how are you?
Just great. Got about a minute before a break here. What's
up?
Yeah,
I'm just sort of banging my head against the wall with this Pat Robertson endorsement of Rudolph Giuliani.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand why in any of the debates Giuliani has been asked about what did you do prior to 9/11. You didn't do, you know, you kept the command center at ground zero, even though the Trade Center had been bombed in 90. Why isn't he being brought down to his knees with what he didn't do? And he's running around the country in the lead campaigning on, you know, Mr.
Well, I am guessing, and I am hoping that whatever Democrat ends up with the nomination will run ads, if Giuliani is the Republican nominee, will run ads that show that those iconic pictures of Rudy Giuliani walking down the street in the middle of Manhattan saying everybody needs to calm down, don't worry, you know, with a mask over his face and stuff, and say, why was Rudy Giuliani on the streets of Manhattan on 9/11? Because his command center was blown up. He had no place else to go. He was officeless. He was essentially homeless. Giuliani blew it. Yeah. Thank you very much, Adam. I appreciate the call. I mean, that's the bottom line. Giuliani, in exchange for a $100,000 campaign contribution, put the command center for the emergency services in the World Trade Center. Duh. Right after, you know, after it had been bombed once.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
This is your home.
Your home for progressive talk.
Air America.
Air America Radio.
AirAmericaRadio.com.
Many are the trials and tears we must overcome. Learn to take it easy, walk in freedom's light, and keep on keeping on till you get it right.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270. Drop into our live chat room over at TomHartman.com. You can participate in our blog over at AirAmerica.com. Yeah, this is Pat Robertson, the guy, let's see, we deserved it. Remember that? I mean, this is...
I really believe that the pagans,
well, that's Falwell,
the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur.
Ms. Pat Robertson.
The problem is we've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
Ah, so we were hit on 9/11 because we had judges on the Supreme Court that Pat Robertson disagreed with. Amazing. 1-866-303-2270. Casey in Seattle. Hey, Casey.
Hi, Tom. I know you're great, and I know that you will get better.
Thank you. Thank you for saving us that.
Yeah, I know, exactly. No, you're awesome. Two quick things. For me, the thing that's so frustrating about talking to, like, conservatives isn't even how they feel, which is usually, you know, completely different from how I feel. It's that it's like when you're talking to a little kid and it's like, you know what, we can't get anywhere in this conversation until you start being honest. So they'll have to lie or bring up these kind of juvenile points that don't even really make any sense, because they can't just say, you know what, we don't like sex, or we have a problem with sex, or whatever, you know what I mean? So
well,
it's like, oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, no, that's fine. What I was going to say is this really highlights the difference between conservative morality and liberal morality. Liberal morality, from the founding of this country, and really I would say from the founding of most of the world's major religions, as a Christian, I find liberal morality most well-defined in Matthew 25, where the disciples said, how do we get into heaven? And Jesus said, you know, if you fed me when I was hungry, if you gave me water when I was thirsty,
yes,
if you visited me when I was in prison, if you healed me when I was sick, if you housed me, you know, when I was homeless, then you'll hang out with me. And they're like, we never saw you, hungry. It's, they're freaked out. And he says, as you did it the least among us, you did it to me. And that's liberal morality. Conservative morality is what are you doing in your bedroom?
Yeah.
What are you smoking in your living room? What are you doing in private? Conservative morality concerns itself with private behavior. Liberal morality concerns itself with public behavior. And that's a very real distinction.
Well, they can't. The other thing is they bring up these analogies that are completely unrelated because they know that their point isn't honest, because they know that it's kind of a BS point. So, like, if somebody says Iraq, you know, they say World War II. Or, like, bringing up segregation when people are talking about birth control.
Right.
It's say, hey, this is how we actually feel. So that's the part that's really frustrating for me.
Yep, well said.
You're awesome. I appreciate you talking with them. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Casey. Much appreciated. Amber in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Amber.
Hi, Tom. I just want to preface this by saying that when it comes to the Bush administration, I am a complete conspiracy theorist, and I don't mind admitting that.
Okay.
However, when I talk to, most people, I accept that most people are not, at least not to the extent that I am.
Mm-hmm.
As a grad student pursuing a science PhD, I like to filter my news through science. You know, I get a lot of my news from science magazines, believe it or not. And I just wanted to draw your attention to a Discover magazine article, which was, I think, about 2 months old. And I apologize, I'm driving, so I don't have the direct citation for you. Just where it kind of detailed how scientific and EPA recommendations for treating the fallout after the actual event were ignored by...
On 9/11.
Yeah, by all on-site individuals, including Mayor Giuliani.
Right. And he participated in that cover-up along with the, I forget her name now, but whoever the woman was who was the head of the EPA at that time.
Yes.
And throughout the Bush administration and Republicans in general, they wanted to wave the bloody shirt. You know, they wanted to do everything they could to score political points, but they frankly didn't give a damn about the people who were working on the ground. And that, I think, if Giuliani becomes the Republican candidate, is going to be one of the major things that's going to come back to haunt him. Amber, thank you very much for calling and pointing that out to our listeners. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, you wanted to talk about Dennis Kucinich?
Yes. I'm a progressive, and I was watching C-SPAN yesterday, and I do not understand why so many Republicans voted not to table the Kucinich resolution.
In the third hour of our program, we are probably going to have Dennis on the program, and whether we do or not, we're going to discuss this issue in more depth. But my understanding of what was going on was that the conventional wisdom within the Beltway, which I think is crazy, but it's accepted by both the Republicans and the Democrats, is that if the Democrats go off and try and impeach Bush or Cheney, that it is going to so anger the American people that they will vote for Republicans in the next election. And so the Republicans were trying to force the Democrats to actually have a conversation on the floor of the House about whether or not Cheney should be impeached. And now it may be that the Republicans were trying to do that because they actually believe that that kind of discussion would be infuriating to the American people. I don't believe that for a minute. It may be that the Republicans were trying to do that because they were trying to reinforce to the Democrats that the Democrats should believe that. In other words, it was sort of the equivalent of Brer Rabbit saying to Brer Bear, please don't throw me in that briar patch. Please don't throw me in that briar patch.
Yeah.
Right. Or in this case, please do throw me in the briar patch of the impeachment discussion. And at that point, the Democrats say, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to throw you in that briar patch of the impeachment discussion. But I think that that's the bottom line, Bernice. Thank you very much for the call. Robert in Newark, California. Hey, Robert.
Yeah, I got one thing that, You changed it in your last discussion, but here's what I called in on, is that the community that is wanted to dispense
right, Portland, Maine.
Yeah, what it is that those people right there were voted in by a very small portion of that community. If the community really wanted what they wanted, then they should have voted for the people that they wanted. It's the people that don't vote that allow.
Good point. But the fact of the matter is, in the months since this has happened, and it's even been smeared all over Fox News, the local community has not moved to withdraw these people. So they're getting support. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, the front page of the Financial Times today, welcome back to the program, by the way. A couple of, frankly, I don't use the word scary very often, but these are scary stories. Number one, risk rises of asset fire sale. They're talking about what could be a Great Depression scenario. Another is about how buyouts are collapsing. A Fed official warns that the subprime strategy that is being followed by the so-called free market isn't working. And on it goes. I'll be sharing more of that with you in the next segment, some of the big picture stuff. But I wanted to start out with the small picture. That is, what can you and I do? What can we do if we're faced with economic difficulties? And I'm very pleased that Aaron Varhola is with us. Aaron is a bankruptcy attorney here in the city of Portland. In fact, he advertises here on AM 620 KPOJ, so our regular listeners here in Portland are familiar with him. They've heard your voice on your ads, Aaron.
Yes, and I'd also... Thank you, Tom, and I'd like to give a shout-out to anyone listening in Pittsburgh on WPTT 1360, especially anyone in my hometown of Bethel Park.
Ah, you're an old Pittsburgh guy, or
yep.
Bethel Park guy. Great, yep. Great. And, in fact, Pittsburgh just elected the youngest mayor in the country, 27 years old, and a Democrat.
Yes, I'm sure that Lynn Cullen on that station has done this to death, but there's been a significant controversy about some of his actions in office, but I'll leave that to her, the Pittsburgh listeners.
There you go. But it was last night was a good election night for Democrats broadly. Aaron, as an attorney, when people come to you and they say, you know, my adjustable rate mortgage is about to kick up and I just won't have the money to pay it, or my credit card debt has reached the point where it's overwhelming and they just jacked the rates up on me because they decided to, or whatever. What's your first advice to people?
I think the first advice I have is to talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about, someone who knows the law. It could be an attorney. I'm not giving legal advice here to any specific person.
Sure.
Could be an attorney. Could be a certified credit counseling agency like the various nonprofit consumer credit counseling agencies of the various cities.
Right.
But there's been a lot of misinformation with people telling people, oh, you can't file for bankruptcy anymore, or it's extremely difficult to file for bankruptcy anymore since the law has changed in 2005. There are some new hurdles that people have to go through if they do want to file for bankruptcy. There's a credit counseling requirement. There's more paperwork requirement, but it's not onerous. You just have to get your tax returns, bank statements, pay stubs, and other financial information into your bankruptcy attorney.
Right. Now, as it seems, whenever you have an absolutely unregulated, laissez-faire, totally, quote, free economy, end quote, the predators come out, and there's very little to restrain them. And I've seen what looks to me, and do a reality check here with me, what looks to me, what sounds to me like a group of stealth predators who are advertising credit counseling services when in fact what they want to do, and they say they'll consolidate all your debt and everything, but basically what they want to do is end up with the title to your home or end up with you refinancing everything that you have, and maybe going from a 25% credit card rate down to an 18% rate with them, but
yes.
Still, it's absurd compared to what you could get if you were talking to you mentioned nonprofit credit counselors. Talk a little bit about the difference between the nonprofit credit counseling services and the for-profit sharks that are out there.
Okay, there's two kinds of for-profit sharks. The first kind I'll talk about very briefly. There are these debt consolidation agencies. They claim they're not-for-profit. That just basically means that they don't give any of their profits back to their shareholders. It goes to their executives and employees.
Right. In other words, yeah. You can incorporate a nonprofit corporation and pay yourself a $600,000 a year salary.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And what they'll do is they'll ask you to make your payments to that company, and they'll impound the payments and try to settle with your credit card companies. Mm-hmm. Problem is that it will ruin your credit worse than anything, as if you had just not paid your credit cards at all. And
why is that?
Because you're not making any attempt to pay the credit cards.
A third party is now dealing with the credit card companies.
Yes,
and that's a huge flag to them.
Yes,
I see.
And eventually they'll settle your debt for 40 or 50 cents on the dollar, but the real problem comes later on because you'll be liable for tax on the amount that was forgiven.
Oh, so if one of these companies negotiates, or for that matter, you negotiate a deal with your credit card company where you pay 50 cents on the dollar, the other 50 cents, you still have to pay income taxes on it as if you had it.
Yes, and you don't have to if it's discharged in a Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 bankruptcy.
Right, and of course, you're a bankruptcy attorney. I mean, you're not here to sell bankruptcy, and I don't think either one of us would ever advocate that as the first step that anybody should consider. This should be the very, very last thing. Am I correct?
Yes, and if people come into my office and I don't think that bankruptcy will help them, I'll tell them that. I mean, I'll say that, listen, you probably need to go to a credit counseling agency, get some budgeting. You
right.
probably have, or you don't have enough debt to file for bankruptcy, because I don't want people to, one of the things in the new bankruptcy laws is that it lengthened the time between bankruptcies between Chapter 7 bankruptcies from 6 to 8 years.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't have enough debt, I wouldn't advise you to waste a Chapter 7 bankruptcy discharge on it.
Right. Now, you said that there were two types of for-profit sharks out there. The first type that masquerades as a not-for-profit. What's the second type?
The second type are predatory lenders. And these people prey on, I wouldn't say uneducated, but people who aren't informed about the financial markets,
mm-hmm.
immigrants. They also profit from redlining, where minorities are steered into these companies thinking that's the only place they can get mortgage money to buy their home.
Right, right. And in fact, there was an interesting piece, I think it was in the New York Times a week or so ago, where they showed they were looking at Detroit and the
yes.
Detroit suburbs. And I'm very familiar with that area. Louise and I lived in Detroit. Our oldest daughter was born in the Livonia Hospital, and we lived in Westland, which was one of those areas that was mostly white, but it was right on the edge of the mostly black area. And then the next town over, Livonia, and where the hospital was, where Kinder was born, was a real fancy white neighborhood.
Yes.
And on the far other end was the really poor black neighborhood. So we saw the whole thing, and we lived there for several years. But they had a couple hundred families in communities that were more than 90% African American, where the average income was around $48,000 a year, and a couple hundred families in communities that were less than 2 miles away that were over 90% white, where the average income was $48,000 a year. Identical,
yes.
In other words, identical credit profiles. And the families in the African American communities were like 3 or 4 times more likely to have these very high interest, adjustable rate, these so-called subprime loans, as opposed to the families in the white neighborhoods. This was not the result of their credit ratings. This was not this redlining is still going on. I thought it was illegal.
Yes, redlining is still going on. My wife, when she bought her house about 6 years ago in Portland, ran into something like that because she had bought the house. She was buying the house from someone who was about to be foreclosed on. And a second mortgage company held out for about $2,000 extra, and eventually they caved in. But I think they assumed because of the neighborhood it was in. It's north of Alberta, about half, three-quarters of a mile north of Alberta in 2000.
This is an area that was largely African-American at the time.
Yes, and they probably saw my wife's profile, a single woman, early in her 30s, government employee, moving into that neighborhood. I think they probably assumed that she was African-American and was trying to redline her to get more money out of her.
Oh, man. Yeah. So what should people, those are the predators that we need to look out for. Who are the good guys? Where are the folks in the proverbial white hats in this thing?
Well, you have to look around for them. The black hat guys are a lot of the subprime mortgage lenders. Right now there's about $1.3 trillion of subprime mortgages out, and about $500 billion of those will reset in the next 12 months.
Right.
So you got to watch out for that.
This is a disaster coming down the road.
Yes. Read your loan documents. And if you have any doubt about your ability to afford it, call a consumer credit counseling person or call a bankruptcy attorney.
So,
not necessarily myself.
So how do you find the good guys? We got about a half a minute here.
You have to shop around. You have to find someone.
What are the flags that tell you this is one of the good guys as opposed to the bad guys?
Doing something called a stated income loan, which means that they don't look for your documents. The reputable people will ask you for finding your financial information and steer you towards a loan that will help you, not one that will put you in debt for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned certified credit counselors when we first started this conversation.
Yes.
Is that something people should be looking for?
Yes. The consumer credit counseling services are usually very reputable, and anyone who's certified by the U.S. trustee of bankruptcy.
Certified by the U.S. trustee. Great. Aaron Varhola, he's a bankruptcy attorney here in Portland, Oregon, and sees the damage that is being done by the wonders of the Reaganomics here over the last 26 years. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us today.
Right. Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. A little more of what's going on here and around the world and what the future may portend right after this. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Everywhere I go, there's glad to see that plastic part. And no matter what the cost is, you know getting it ain't hard. You sign along the dotted line, you can take it home today. Buddy, let me tell you, you're gonna pay and pay and pay. Oh, MasterCard, you mastered me. I'll still be paying when I'm 83. The things I bought are broke or gone. Oh, MasterCard, where'd I go wrong? Oh, MasterCard, you've mastered me.
The Arizona Republican, welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. The Arizona Republican reporting more Arizonans filed for bankruptcy protection in October than any prior month this year, as the weak housing market and tighter lending conditions exerted a toll on consumers. Filings for bankruptcy up 61% from a year earlier. That's in Phoenix, for example. The Fed... This is downright spooky. This is a news analysis that's in the Financial Times of London about the U.S. economy, the U.S. edition. Doubts are emerging about whether the financial industry's case-by-case approach to altering loans to make them affordable is enough to deal with the challenge. See, basically what's going on is we've got this crisis. All these folks were given mortgages that they basically can't afford and in many cases didn't even know the details of. And those mortgages now are adjusting upward. And they're adjusting upward, as Aaron shared with you just before the break, in huge numbers. I mean, we're looking at very large numbers. And the consequence of that is, for example, as the Chicago Tribune just reported, over 635,000 foreclosures were filed during the last quarter, August, September, and October, double from the period last year. Over at the Huffington Post, Hale Stewart showing a couple of interesting graphs. Number one, average household income, median national household income in the United States has gone down since the last years of the Clinton administration. At the same time, household debt in the United States in 2001, when Bush came into office, was around $7,000. It's now around $14,000, average household debt. So our debt has doubled, our income has gone down, bankruptcy filings up, and there are these, zillions of these things, these subprime loans. And so they asked the banks and the lending companies to, hey, would you guys voluntarily start just going easy on these people, and instead of jacking their interest rate from 4% up to 20%, just jack it up from 4 to maybe 7 or 8? Turns out what they found is that lenders have eased terms on just 1% of subprime loans, resetting from introductory to higher rates earlier this year. This from Randall Krosner, who is one of the governors of the Federal Reserve and the Fed's top official on housing-related issues. He said the scale of the problem requires a more systematic approach. In other words, he says the government needs to do something. But, of course, you got cons in charge of the government to a large extent, and they don't think the government should do anything. And then here's the kicker, again, from the Financial Times. But investors argue, this would be the banks, investors argue that standardized approaches will lead to reduced revenues from borrowers who might otherwise be able to pay. In other words, we won't be able to squeeze as much profit out of these people. What? Now, in the meantime, this huge front page story in the Financial Times, just a screaming headline, risk rises of asset fire sale. And it's showing dollars. And they show the price of gold, the price of oil, and the value of the dollar crashing. And they say the threat of fire sales of mortgage-backed securities is mounting as rating agencies' downgrades have pushed complex debt vehicles into technical default. Let me translate that into English. There are all these securities out there, all these things that people bought thinking that they would make money as they increased in value over time. And in fact, what's happening is they are crashing. And if they crash really hard, if they go through the floor, it could take everything with it. Back to the Financial Times. The prospect of forced sales of assets comes as a U.S. Treasury-backed plan for a super fund to stabilize troubled credit markets appears to have stalled. You recall 3-4 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, I shared with you all the wonderful news for the financial markets. The banks are voluntarily getting together and putting together this $5 billion fund to deal with the defaults on these instruments, these bundled mortgage loans. Well, the banks now are in so much trouble, they can't do it. And as David Whiten and Sascha Sulz in Gilliam Tutt in the Financial Times write, forced sales will drive prices down even more, putting increased pressure on banks with subprime-related exposure. So as these bundled securities become worth less, they're harder to sell, and so the price of them it creates a downward spiral. And this, by the way, they note, is raising expectations that the Fed is going to have to cut interest rates. If they do that, what's going to happen? The dollar is going to crash even more. We're looking at huge inflation, stagflation, gold and oil going through the roof, and basically the United States becoming impoverished. The $75 billion Superfund plan designed to purchase assets from, now this is where they're bailing out the big guys, seems to have stalled as well. So the $5 billion plan to bail out the little guy, that's gone. The $75 billion plan to bail out the big guys, that's not working. One senior Wall Street banker said, as far as we can see, it appears dead in the water right now. As a consequence, Citigroup shares down another 2%, Morgan Stanley down 2%. This is over a 20% fall over the past week, these two large banks. This is spooky stuff. At the same time, the story below it, failed buyouts double to exceed $200 billion as credit squeeze bites. Corporations can't raise money anymore to buy other companies. So this is just rippling right across the system. Right across the system. The wonders of the so-called free market. This is what happens when you absolutely let go. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
That's the American dream. What has happened to the American dream? I'll tell you what happened to the American dream. Reaganomics. Ronald Reagan set into place this whole idea that the government is the enemy, not the friend.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And so so as he said, the government is the problem, not the solution. And so the government stopped regulating things like mortgage loans and credit card companies, and to a large extent, you know, cut back on regulation of these things. Let's just let the free market do everything. And let's stop regulating things like international trade and where jobs go and whether or not we have jobs in America. And as a consequence, you get these situations like this phone call that E.J. Montini, brilliant writer at the Arizona Republic, got back on May 4th, 2004, on his answering machine. He wrote an op-ed piece about it. You can find it over at the Arizona Republic's website. I believe he could for some time, E.J. Montini. And he put the call up on the Internet. Here it is.
I'm calling in, and I'm promising myself not to cry, but you're always right about things that are going on in the current events. I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed, I'm 43 years old, and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years, and we've always worked. A year ago, I lost my job. 6 months ago, his job was outsourced to India. We have three children. One that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college. But anyway, I just wondered, there's so many of us, and people don't seem to notice what's going on. And nobody, I read the paper, and I don't see a lot of people writing about it. And I know there's a lot of them out there because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, I mean, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I mean, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, it'd be neat if somebody would write and make the country aware that, I feel like invisible. You go to the grocery store and it's like, see, we were an invisible section, but I think there's like millions of us. So anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything, and you make it good. And nobody hears us. So
to respond or forward, press 1. To delete, press star D.
And E.J. Montini wrote in his column, I mean, this was a voicemail to him, about this situation and how bad. And this is from 3 years ago, from 2004, May 4th, 2004. About how, you know, how something should be done. We should be doing something about this. And how he didn't want to delete her answer or her message, and he did want to answer it, but you know, what to say? I'll tell you what to say. You know, not speaking to EJ, he's a great guy and a brilliant columnist, but to the conservatives who have brought this upon us, is that we need to bring back the social safety net. We need to bring back the New Deal. We need to bring back the concept of an America that actually works and takes care of itself. And I know there are voices out there that say, no. That era of the middle class, you know, from the 1940s to the 1980s, that's over. Reagan rolled it back. And in fact,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, right down to regulating banks. And we're seeing how it's working. And it ain't working very well. Thank you very much. Jack in San Diego, California. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind today?
The subprime debacle. I think Americans are really going to be surprised if the dollar gets replaced by the euro and the euro becomes the benchmark currency.
For oil, you mean?
What's that?
For oil, you mean?
For commodities in general.
Yeah. Well, it's rapidly happening. It's rapidly happening. I predict within two years, probably at the most, that will be the case. And then you're going to see a major recalibration of the standard of living in the United States. We could see a depreciation of the dollar by 50%. I mean, it's already depreciated arguably by 30% since Bush came into office.
Well, look, America is on sale right now because if you're holding euros or even, what is it they call it, the loonie, the Canadian dollar?
Yeah, the loonie.
Any of these foreign currencies, I mean, you can invest in the America's stock market, our ports, our airports, our toll roads. You can get everything on sale for a 40% discount. But well, I wanted to add two points to Tom, to this argument on the subprime loan debacle. The first point is when borrowers are told to contact their lender and renegotiate the loan, that's almost impossible because the lenders sold the loans. The loan originators became the servicing agent, and in many cases, the borrower doesn't know who owns the loan, and in some cases, the loan originator doesn't know who owns the loan because the CMOs and CDOs have been traded around the world like baseball cards.
Right. It might be owned by a company in China now.
Or a bank in London or France.
Right.
The second point is that you talked about the ripple effect. Well, here's a new one that just came to light this week, and that is there's going to be a problem with the creditworthiness on municipal bonds because now, because of the lower home values, there's a decrease in property taxes. And so we have seen, you know, I'm calling you from California. I can remember when Orange County went bankrupt. This is the ripple effect as far as how this is going to ripple through the economy with jobs. I'll make a prediction that this guy, Ben Bernanke, the new chairman of the Federal Reserve, a Bush appointee, is going to continue to lower rates into this election cycle.
Yeah.
And when a Democrat gets elected president, he's going to raise rates, cause the collapse of this economy, and it's going to get blamed on the Democrats.
That's right. I have been saying that for 2 years. And you know, it's the Jimmy Carter scenario. And there will be the stagflation. And yeah, it's absolutely, especially if there's a Democratic president in the White House.
Now, there is a solution for homeowners.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what's happening here in California. There's a couple of big legal firms that have started class action lawsuits because in many cases, the borrowers were not fully informed about all the details of the loan, otherwise known as failure to disclose. They can sue and get some relief and join a class action lawsuit. That might be their best and only opportunity to get out of this mess.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the heads up on that, Jack.
All right,
appreciate
buddy.
The call. Good to hear from you. Mike in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks. Tom, yesterday you spoke about how much our American dollar has been deflated under Bush. Can you repeat that for me?
Well, the devaluation against the euro has been almost 30% since Bush came into office. One of our callers from Canada pointed out that it's been more than 50% compared to the Canadian dollar, and since Canada is our largest trading partner, that's probably a more appropriate benchmark. I mean, so, and the reason that they do this, the reason that Bush is having to do this is because the bill is coming due for all the money that Reagan borrowed. Reagan sold all these 20-year treasuries and, you know, borrowed trillions of dollars to then give that money to his buddies in the defense industry for his so-called Star Wars program, some $2.5-3 trillion. Reagan borrowed more money during his 8 years as president than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined.
Right.
You take the money we borrowed to fight the Revolutionary War, and we fought that on credit. The money we borrowed to fight the War of 1812, which we fought on credit, the money that that Lincoln had to borrow for the Civil War, the money for the Spanish-American War, the money that we had to borrow for World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, which was borrowed on credit. That's what the payoff on that is what caught Jimmy Carter. And Reagan borrowed more money than all of those combined. And now Bush has borrowed about as much as Reagan has borrowed. So Reagan comes into office, we have a $1 trillion debt, more or less. He leaves office, we got a $4 trillion debt. Now we're pushing $9 trillion in debt. But the bill is coming due right now on those 20-year treasuries for Reagan's debt, and we're having to pay them off. And so Bush is looking at this going, why should I pay off a $1 billion worth of treasuries with $1 billion when I can pay it off with $500 million that's called $1 billion by decreasing the value of the dollar? And they pretty much announced this a year and a half ago. I talked about it at some length on this program when Jon Snow was talking about talking down the dollar.
Yeah. Tom, I got to ask you one quick question.
Yeah.
How did all this happen?
It happened with the election of Ronald Reagan. It's the coup of the elites. They did not want a middle class in the United States, a strong middle class.
But why isn't our system of checks and balances been working properly?
That's a damn good question. Let me contemplate it over the break, Mike, and I'll get back with you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for the call. 44 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Save us from hypocrisy, save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing, stop cheating us as spies. Save our
jobs from leaving, bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who pave your way. Save us from your pay raise while our long wages do fall. Save us from the price of gas while giving this to oil. Save us from your gridlock and the constantly relent. You're still on our time clock, so you might start representing.
Yeah, that's a plan. Save the USA. Okay, an answer to our last caller. How did this happen? What happened to checks and balances? First of all, it's happened before. We are back where we were in the 1920s, which led right up to the Republican Great Depression. And before that, we were back where we were before Teddy Roosevelt during the time of the Gilded Age. It's a pendulum that keeps swinging back and forth in the United States between unregulated, unrestrained, laissez-faire, total Wild West capitalism, where by and large the middle class gets wiped out, the poor get poorer, and the rich get richer. And those progressive times, like from 1940 to 1980, and from 1900 to 1918, from the founding of this country until the 1820s, from the beginning of the Civil War until Reconstruction until the 1880s, those progressive eras where the middle class actually starts getting stronger. And I track it all the way back to Ronald Reagan selling the whole idea of deregulation and getting Americans to go along with it somehow. You know, it's just amazing. He stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was a major hold down on an economy going nuts. Number one. And number two, drop the top interest rate or the top income rate on people making more than $3.2 million a year in today's tax dollars, from 91%, well, under Roosevelt, 71% under Kennedy, dropped it down to 28%. And number three, he doubled the tax on people working people who were earning less than, at the time, $35,000 a year by doubling the Social Security tax. So Reagan began the deconstruction of this whole process, and now here we are with the subprime mess, the credit card mess, all of these the consequences of absolute unregulated so-called free markets. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
You're talking taxes. I think I'll talk about the plan to fix the alternative minimum tax problem. Of course, at the point it was made, it was supposed to cover rich people, but now income has risen in terms of dollar amount.
Or the dollar has fallen.
However you want to put it. I don't think the standard has risen, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But the plan now is to somehow fix the alternative minimum tax, but not raise taxes because they're worried that other Democrats who are in sort of swing districts may be, you know, finger pointed by the Republicans that they voted to raise your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to do that right before the election, it looks like.
Hmm. Interesting. Any specifics on what's going to happen?
I mean, just that somehow, I think Rahm Emanuel is behind this plan too, because he's very worried that all these newly elected Democrats may go bye-bye if somehow, in order to fix the alternative minimum tax, they raise taxes in another area.
Seems to me they need to do it before April, you know, when people realize that they're having to pay it. And probably the solution would be, I don't know where the AMT kicks in. I think it's, $120,000, $140,000 a year, something like that. That they just raise it to $200,000 to $250,000 a year, and now you're starting to get into the realm where it's affecting a much smaller number of potential voters.
Right, that's true. That's true. But that's what's happening on taxes since you let in with taxes. Couple other interesting things. The employment non-discrimination debate is happening as we speak in the House. So there's some good get out the popcorn talks by Republicans, kind of interesting on that. Dennis Kucinich just made an impassioned two-minute speech on that. Also, tomorrow is the FISA vote, and that is going to happen. It is part of, as you know, the Senate Judiciary already passed the Protect America Act, and it has to do with a question. Now it's the Select Committee, the Senate Select Committee. I'm sorry, it's tomorrow. The Judiciary Committee that is taking a look at it. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence already took a look at it. And Mark Klein is all over the Hill. He's the guy that actually brought what AT&T was doing. As you know, Quest refused to participate in this. He told what AT&T has done, and it looks like they were not just interested in phone conversations. They were using AT&T's links to get into all of the other companies' internet. So that, in other words, everything was somehow flowing through that AT&T connection. And it was not just, as I said, phone calls, et cetera, that they were looking at. They were also looking at domestic emails on the internet.
Well, just because in certain parts of the country, AT&T owns the big pipes that everything has to pass through to get anywhere from anywhere to anywhere?
That's right. It was clearly a pipe issue. And, yeah. And
not a truck issue.
Yeah.
And not a truck issue, as Senator Stevens would say.
Right.
The internet's in pipes, not trucks.
Exactly. A couple other really interesting things today. The French president, who is just in about an hour going to give a press briefing with the president at Mount Vernon, talked to Congress and very, very positive, except for the fact that he slipped in this little thing about, and you know more about monetary policy than I do by a long shot, but he's concerned about what he considered fair exchange rates with the dollar. And he said it does not help if we get into some kind of monetary war. It would not help anybody.
Was this with regard to a specific currency like China or just broadly?
No, he said everybody was concerned about that, but that he was concerned about American currency and what we were demanding around that. And again, this is not my field of expertise. So
interesting.
I thought you may have a little more insight into that than.
Well, most currencies just completely float free. So the value of the currencies relative to each other is a function of what people are willing to pay for them in a buying and selling environment. And so you've got people currency trade. I mean, this is how Warren Buffett? I think. No. This is how George Soros made so much money. It was betting against the currency of Thailand and some of the other Middle Eastern countries or Southeast Asian countries. And when the currencies collapsed, he made a fortune. And
as somebody says, there are a lot of these guys that that do things that we would just be horrified about, and then they wind up making all this money, and then they try and be good and give it away to everybody.
Yeah, well, I think George Soros is a good guy. I think he just saw which way the wind was blowing and said,
right,
hey, I can make some money on this. But the point is that there are some countries that peg their currencies. China is one of them. And we've been saying to China, you can't peg your currency to the dollar. You know, if we're going to let the dollar fall, and it's fallen 30% since Bush came into office, then your currency has to go up in value by 30%. In other words, Chinese goods have to become more expensive. And that presumably would increase our exports and decrease our imports, which would help our balance of trade payments. But China says, no, we're not going to play that game. And so it's giving the administration fits.
France agrees on that, but doesn't agree on other things that the U.S. dollar is doing. Now, another interesting thing that came up today in the morning briefing at the White House was the issue of Pakistan and the fact that the president still has not made direct contact with Musharraf.
Wow. He still hasn't had a phone conversation with him?
Nope.
Oh, that's either really good news or really bad news, and frankly, I'm not sure which. I can see both sides of that.
I don't think it's such good news.
Yeah, I suspect I'm inclined to agree with you. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Our hero of the day, Dennis Kucinich, introducing a resolution yesterday for the impeachment of Richard Cheney. Dick Cheney doesn't apparently like people to know, according to Chris Matthews, that he actually pronounces his name Cheney, whereas he kind of likes it that everybody else calls him Cheney. But nonetheless, Dennis Kucinich putting forward this proposal. Dennis Kucinich on the line with us. Congressman Kucinich, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
the opportunity.
You're more than welcome. I'm very pleased to have you on. In fact, since the last time I went to your website and donated money to your campaign, I've been getting all these emails about what you're up to and what's going on and with this. And tell us about what's happening with this impeachment resolution.
It's been referred to committee, and it's House Resolution
$7.99. And that bill just yesterday went to the Judiciary Committee, and now there's a chance for people from all across the country to contact the Democratic leadership and let them know that you want a hearing on that bill. And right. I think that the American people deserve nothing less.
Yeah, I agree. People can find out more information by about this, by the way, at Kucinich.us, Kucinich.house.gov, or your For President site, DennisDigitForPresident.com. And if you want the phone number to call your member of Congress, we've got a website up, callcongress.org, which has all the toll-free numbers that we've been able to find, as well as, of course, the main switchboard number in. If you're not sure who represents you in Congress, give me your zip code. They will, the fine operators there will connect you. Dennis, or Congressman Kucinich, the story yesterday about the Republicans being against this and then being for this, and that they were doing it because they were trying to embarrass the Democrats into having a discussion. This smells to me like a Brer Rabbit, Brer Bear story. Like the Republicans are trying to convince the Democrats that the Democrats should be afraid of having this conversation, and the Republicans think that the Democrats should be afraid of having this conversation, when in fact I think that the Republicans are afraid of having this conversation. Are we seeing a double take here?
Well, let's put it this way. We could have impeached the vice president yesterday, and Congress missed what was a clear opportunity when the motion to table was defeated. We had an opportunity to go right for the bill instead of referring it to committee. The issue here is less the ins and outs of a parliamentary contest than it is that we're losing our nation, Tom. We're losing our nation to lies and to war and to debt, and this Congress is not standing up for the Constitution of the United States, because if it was, it would call this vice president to an accounting for the lies that he told that took us into war against Iraq, and for the lies that he's telling that would take us into war against Iran.
I agree with you totally. Absolutely. And I'm curious, how did this thing end up in committee? I mean, was this a decision made by Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, or was there a vote? I mean, explain the background.
When the motion to table failed, the next effort was to try to send it to committee, so it wouldn't have been acted on the floor yesterday. I felt that we had an opportunity over the past 7 months to have a hearing, because the bill has been in the Judiciary Committee under the number House Resolution 333. There was never a hearing on it because the leadership has effectively stopped it from happening. However, now that there's been a national movement, and make no mistake about it, and your listeners know this, there is a national grassroots movement that has nothing to do with Washington, that has everything to do with the fact that people believe that our Constitution is being shredded by this administration. They're demanding that Congress take action, which is the relief available under Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution, to hold the chief executive officers, in this case the vice president, accountable through an impeachment proceeding. And the American people are insisting on this. I mean, I've heard from people everywhere, and they are demanding that their Constitution be protected. And so that's why I introduced the articles of impeachment yesterday after a long wait. And frankly, we don't need to wait any longer. The American people need to be heard from. I'm happy to have people go to my website at Kucinich.us. Any comments that they have, we will pass along to the leadership of the House, and we're going to let people know in Washington that justice is not going to be denied any longer.
A quick question. We're talking with Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who yesterday introduced articles of impeachment against Richard Cheney, the vice president of the United States. John Conyers, now, he's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and this is in his committee. The committee issued a statement saying, you know, we've got a lot of important things to do here, quack, 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 quack. But at the very end, it seemed like in that statement there was sort of an out. The very end, it said the chairman will discuss today's votes with the committee members, but it would seem evident that the committee staff should continue to consider, as a preliminary matter, the many abuses of this administration, including the vice president. What do you think the chances are that John Conyers will move forward with this?
Well, John Conyers, according to many members of Congress who talked to him yesterday, indicated a willingness to hold hearings. And I think that we need to ask John Conyers to proceed with those hearings. He is chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
We also understand that the Democratic leadership
has been discouraging any action from being taken. But listen, Tom, I don't like having to contest with my own leadership on this. But I think that they're not in tune with the concerns of the American people about an administration that took us into war based on lies, that would take us into another war against Iran, using, by the way, or to read the news reports out of Washington a couple of weeks ago, B-2 bombers dropping 30,000-pound bombs on nuclear research labs in Iran, which would create a humanitarian and ecological disaster. I mean, this is an urgent matter. This isn't. We're not talking about politics as usual or government as usual here. We have an urgent matter here where the safety and security of this nation and of the world is at risk with an administration that's on the warpath.
Yeah.
That's why I feel a sense of urgency about it, Tom, and that's why I moved yesterday, and that's why I am going to be relentless about this.
And people can find more information at Kucinich.us. Yeah, I absolutely agree. This is something entirely different than whether Dick Cheney had sex with an intern in the White House. I mean, people are dying. We have the second largest refugee crisis in the world in Iraq right now. 4.5 million displaced people behind Darfur. And arguably as many as 1 million people dead. And now they want to do it in a third country. This is crazy. Congressman Kucinich, should people be calling John Conyers' office? Should they be calling their own member of the House of Representatives and ask?
What I would ask. I would ask people to go to my website at Kucinich.us and sign up and make it, you know, and give me a note about your position on impeachment and what you think. I want to hear from people. I'm going to collect those, and I'm going to deliver them to the Judiciary Committee and give copies to the Speaker of the House and to the Majority Leader, so they know exactly what's going on. And I'll report back to you to let you know about how many emails we've received relative to impeachment. You can go to info@Kucinich.us, or you can just go to Kucinich.us and then follow the prompts through to leave a message. But I will carry these directly to the Democratic officials, so they'll know. Every day that they see me here in Washington, they're going to know that the American people are demanding that action be taken. I think our country's at risk. I think we're losing our country.
And
we have to save our country.
I absolutely agree with you. And how do you answer those in the media? I've heard this a number of times now from the supposed mainstream media that, oh, this is just Dennis Kucinich doing another campaign stunt.
Well, you know, you have to keep in mind that the media rolled over on the war in Iraq. If the media had done its job and the media told the truth, we wouldn't have gone to war. The New York Times, for example, has just as much responsibility for the war in Iraq as the president and the vice president, because they uncritically carried information to the general public that caused people to believe there was a cause for war. Now, we all are mediums. We all have the ability to carry a message, and each of us must carry the message. The national media is very insular here in Washington. They like to, it's like an in-house game and a club. But this is no time for indulging in that kind of an approach to politics. The nation's at risk here. The nation is more than what's inside the Beltway. The nation is, you know, from literally one sea to another and beyond that. And we need to embrace the fullness of America and to take the power from the hearts of the people of this country and save our country again. Because it's at risk with an administration that has taken us to a war based on lies, and that's ready to create an humanitarian catastrophe and an ecological catastrophe by an attack on Iran. We cannot let this happen. That's why I brought this matter forward. I feel a sense of urgency, and I think that the American people do as well. So everyone who's listening, if you want to participate, go to Kucinich.us. I'll get your messages delivered, not only to the Democratic leadership, but if you want to mention the congressional district, it may facilitate my delivering it to various members of Congress. I'm just going to keep reminding people that we're not here for ourselves. We're here to fulfill a dream that the founders had and that generations of Americans have contributed to, of a government of the people. We're going to lose that dream if we don't take a stand, and now is the time to take a stand.
Well said. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Kucinich.us, the website. Also, callcongress.org if you want the phone numbers to call your members of Congress. But great effort that you're doing, sir, and thank you very much for standing up for this country and for our Constitution.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 17 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Coming up tomorrow, we're going to have a debate, both sides, pro and con, on the 9/11 truth debate. Kevin Ryan, co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and Michael Shermer of Skeptic Magazine. Should be interesting. Friday, I'll be in Phoenix. We'll be doing the show live from KPHX, our affiliate there. And if you want to show up for the gig at the Harkins Theater, I'll be giving a talk on Cracking the Code, my new book. And that requires tickets, and they're actually selling the tickets at 1480kphx.com. So you have to go to their website. On Monday in Philadelphia, White Dog Cafe, a free gig, 6 o'clock dinner, 7:30. I'll be speaking on Cracking the Code. On Tuesday, the Strand Bookstore. Richard Belzer will be introducing me, a great guy and friend. I'll be signing the new book, Cracking the Code, at 7 o'clock at the Strand Bookstore in New York City. On the 14th, I'll be at Demos, the think tank, as it were, in New York, at 5:30 p.m. And on Friday of next week in San Francisco, green960.com is the website for more information. We'll be at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City from 3:30 to 6 p.m. We've done that before. Should be a great time and a lot of fun. Oh, and November 17th, I don't know how I missed this. On November 17th, that's Saturday, I'll be at the Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel, California. So a lot going on. This is the statement from Congressman John Conyers from his office. And I find the wording of this fascinating. In the chat room, one of the folks pointed out an article that suggested that that Conyers has been told that if he actually starts holding hearings on impeachment, his chairmanship of the committee has been threatened by Speaker Pelosi. I frankly find that hard to believe, but who knows? In any case, this is the statement from the committee. Quote, the committee has a very busy agenda. Over the next 2 weeks, we hope to pass a FISA bill, to vote on contempt of Congress citations, to pass legislation on prisoner reentry, court security, and a variety of other very important items. We were surprised that the minority, that would be the Republicans, was so ready to move forward with consideration of a matter of such complexity as impeaching the vice president. The chairman, that would be John Conyers, will discuss today's vote with the committee members, but it would seem evident that the committee staff should continue to consider, as a preliminary matter, the many abuses of this administration, including the vice president. Well, that's a whole lot better than, hey, it's off the table, which is what Steny Hoyer said. So yes, you can go to Dennis Kucinich's website, Kucinich.us, and let him know that you support him and pass him, give him, sign his petition. I would go a step further. I would contact my own member of Congress directly. Let them hear from me. And I have, for that matter. And if you go to callcongress.org, you can get the phone numbers, or you can simply call. Here's the main number for the switchboard in Washington, D.C., 202-225-3121. And then there's a bunch of 800 numbers. They come and go. Different organizations sponsor them for a while, and then they take them down. Sometimes they're issue-based, whatever. We try to aggregate them on the website. If you know of any, let me know. We'll add them to it. If any of them don't work, let me know. Yesterday, right after I had suggested that people call Steny Hoyer, the switchboard, we were actually unable to get through to the switchboard on Capitol Hill. Apparently the phones were just totally slammed. So if you got a busy signal, just, wait 15 minutes and call back. But these are the issues. And frankly, they're issues that some of the prescient ones among us have seen before. This is Frank Zappa on Crossfire in the 1980s.
The biggest threat to America today is not communism. It's moving America toward a fascist theocracy. And everything that's happened during the Reagan administration is steering us right down that pipe.
Oh, Mr. Zappa, do you?
Yes,
do
Mr.
That would
Zappa.
Be Robert Novak.
Really I really think that. All kidding aside, in this country, with the permissiveness that we are moving toward a fascist theocracy, anything
you
goes.
We are, but,
I mean, do you think things like this would ever
give me
been
that
permitted?
Famous smile again.
When we were kids, you're about my age, maybe
I'm
a little 45.
Younger.
Well, I'm 55. Do you think when I was a kid that they would permit songs like that to be sold? I mean, permissiveness is the game. I mean, you're not really serious if you're saying we're going toward a fascist theocracy.
That's right, we are.
Wait a minute.
In what way?
Give me one example of a fascist theocracy.
When you have a government that prefers a certain moral code derived from a certain religion, and that moral code turns into legislation to suit one certain religious point of view, and if that code happens to be very, very right-wing, almost toward Matilda Hunt...
Well, then you are an anarchist. Every form of civil government is based on some kind of morality, Frank.
Morality in terms of behavior, not
well, of course,
in terms of theology.
There you go. The late, great Frank Zappa. Here we are.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
They both try to put us to town. Just because we could get around. Get on.
Well, Sonny, here we are. You're getting older.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Judith in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Judith, welcome to the program. Judith, you are on the air, if you are listening.
I'm sorry?
You're on the air.
I know I'm on the air. I heard
you. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you.
I said, I've been to the library. I've seen all the books you've written. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. You know, I was cable jumping this morning, and it was full of disappearing wives and policemen who was killed by a prisoner, yet nothing about Dennis Kucinich's House Resolution 799.
Yeah.
But a great, you know, this would have been a great man on the street kind of camera interview.
It would have. And in fact, Lauren at Air America was just sending me a note a few minutes ago about that it's the 25th anniversary of something with the Rolling Stones or the Beatles or something like that. And that's the big story at CNN. Rather than, you know, impeachment proceeding, a majority of Congress agrees that an impeachment proceeding against the sitting vice president of the United States should be kept alive.
Yep. Well, anyhow, people forget about the FCC giveaway and the inability to provide good health care and the NAFTA under Clinton. And, you know, there's going to be a public hearing, I think, for FCC in Seattle next week.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, but something that happened to me yesterday, I noticed a stranger holding an architectural manual by the law school that I live near, and it had satellite pictures of our neighborhood. When I asked what he was doing, he flashed a badge that said Homeland Security. Yeah. And this is something. What's he doing in my neighborhood?
Yeah.
What, you know, there's a golf course there. There's
Judith, I don't have any idea, but they're out there. I'm telling you, they're out there. There's a lot of them. Thanks for the call. Kevin in New York City. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Thanks for being there.
You're welcome.
How do we get you to go on cable television? We need a TV show.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people who do TV very, very well, and I'm not sure that I'm one of them. We're going to be playing with some video here from the show. Stay tuned, as they say. But I'm a radio guy. I've been doing radio since I was 16 years old. I love radio.
Well, I wanted to talk about you're talking about on the economic side. Just as an illustration of where the dollar is at, a friend of mine just came back from Italy. He took 100 euros out of the ATM machine, and when he saw his bank statement, it was $145.
That's right. Yeah, and I remember when you could buy a euro for 87 cents.
Yeah. So. One thing I wanted to ask you, you were talking about this depression scenario. What is a little guy going to do to protect themselves from a catastrophic crash like that? I mean, we have to save bags of gold, or I mean, what do we do?
Well, you know, talking with Ravi Batra about this, and we've had a few other economists on, the consensus seems to be either get absolutely out of debt and as secure and tight in with your community as you can, in a position to even grow your own food and you know, have access to resources if necessary, or if that's absolutely impossible, then consider going in debt as far as you can and using those resources to, like you said, to buy gold and to have stuff that might be durable. But at a certain point, doing that could be considered fraud. So I would not advise doing that with the intention of, for example, declaring bankruptcy or something. But if everything were to collapse around us, I honestly don't know. I don't think that there is an easy answer to that question. You look at what happened during the Great Depression. You look at what happened during the Depression of 1898, the panic. You look at what happened in the panic of the 1870s, the late 1870s. You look at what happened in the panic of 1846 that arguably led to the Civil War. And you know, even looking at all of those, or at what happened in Germany with the hyperinflation after World War One. I just don't see any easy answers. The powerful and the wealthy come through just fine, thank you very much, by and large, and the average person gets screwed. And so, you know, developing your skills, developing your network of friends, living as lightly as possible on the earth, getting out of debt to the extent that it's possible, and paying off your debt, downscaling and downsizing your life so that it's more sustainable if you know, God forbid, something like this should happen. That's the best I can come up with.
Well, that's pretty frightening that we even have to contemplate this.
Well, actually, let me add one other thing, and that is, you know, what got us out of the Great Depression was Franklin Roosevelt. The New Deal got us out of the Great Depression. The Square Deal, Teddy Roosevelt, got us out of the panic of the late 1980s, got us out of what was arguably the Big Depression before that. Tragically, the Civil War got us out of the Depression of the 1840s and the 1850s. So, politics plays a big role in this, Kevin, and so getting politically active is no small thing, and I'd say that's another thing on the list. I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Vince in El Cajon, California. Hey, Vince.
Hey, Tom, do you think Bush's approval ratings have hit his IQ numbers yet?
Actually, Vince,
the old Mendoza line.
Yeah, I know. But I think that we do ourselves a disservice if we think that George Bush is stupid. You don't get to be president of the United States if you're stupid. You could be vice president. Dan Quayle was not very bright, but that was basically an appointed position by Bush's dad.
What's it at now? 24? I think Charles Manson probably has better numbers than that.
And his disapproval rating is above where Nixon's was. It's around 50%. So yeah,
well, in 50 years, we'll really be able to judge him. You know, he'll be thought of like Herbert Hoover or Taft or something like that. That's what every time I hear Bush talk, he says, "Well, 50 to 100 years."
Well, that's all he's got to rely on now is an intangible future. I mean, you know, it's an absolute tragedy. But Vince, your point is well made. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to what you said earlier about whether it was a good thing for Bush to talk to Musharraf or not.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, geez, maybe, maybe not. I mean, like, it could be a good thing because, you know, he tends to botch it up. You know, he doesn't, you know, his diplomacy, it's a chess game. You know, Bush's sophistication doesn't go, you know, much beyond chess, but as bad as that is, he isn't even trying to, I mean, doesn't go beyond checkers, but as bad as that is, he doesn't even try to play checkers, you know, he thinks he can play Smash Mouth, and there's no love lost between him and Musharraf, I don't think, if you recall when Bush went to India, which is Pakistan's enemy in a way.
Yeah.
And
sold them nuclear power technology.
And
Musharraf protested and Bush just basically flipped him off.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Dan, you're absolutely right. And Bush is, and thank you for the call. Bush is faced now, we are faced. And I think that we have to acknowledge this and realize the gravity of it. We are faced with some really tough decisions. We set off, for all practical purposes, a bomb on the border of Pakistan by invading Afghanistan, which is something that no Western country has ever successfully pulled off. Every time Europeans try to invade Afghanistan, they get their heads handed to them and their butts kicked, including the Soviet Union. And, you know, arguably one of the largest military forces in the world at the time. by invading Afghanistan right on the border with Pakistan and then invading Iraq and inflaming the Muslim world, what we have done is we have stirred up so much anti-Western sentiment, so much anti-small-d democracy sentiment in Pakistan, that the one hope that we could have had for Pakistan, which is that either Musharraf would become democratic, and I think, frankly, there was a time when that was a hope, even though the guy is basically a despot and a dictator and he came to power in a coup, but that he might become democratic, or that Benazir Bhutto might come in an election, you might have a democratically elected, again, small-d democratically elected president, leader of the country, that Pakistan could become a democracy, that hope has been dramatically and tragically diminished. Because the ferment, I mean, you know, this is the second most populous Muslim country in the world. They have a nuclear weapon. They're, Osama bin Laden is living there. They've got Al-Qaeda. We could have completely eliminated or largely eliminated, certainly neutralized Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had, instead of bombing Afghanistan from the get-go, if instead we had said to the Taliban, if we had taken their offer and said, okay, we'll take Osama bin Laden from you. Actually, they didn't offer him to us. They said that they would give him over to a neutral third country where you'd get a trial for 9/11. And if we said, fine, let's put the guy on trial and convict him of, the same has happened with Tim McVeigh. And the families of 9/11 would have closure, and the world would say, yep, America still respects the rule of law. And with bin Laden and his support for the Taliban out of Afghanistan, I think you would see a gradual loosening of the Taliban's power in Afghanistan. It was already starting to decay. The Northern Alliance was coming after them. The warlords were coming after them, which really, I mean, we call them the warlords. They're really tribal chieftains. I mean, it was a coalition at the best. But we have set off this bomb on Pakistan's border by bombing Afghanistan and invading Afghanistan and now occupying it to a large extent, and by occupying and invading Iraq. And so it may be that over the short term, there is so much Islamist, anti-American, anti-democratic sentiment that if an election were to be held right now, and this is something I don't think anybody knows, and this is apparently what Musharraf, either he wasn't willing to risk this or he is a power-crazed nut, or both. But if an election were held, I mean, it might be like in Egypt, where Mubarak had to basically pull the plug on the election because it looked like he was going to have elected into office somebody who was going to say, okay, this is an Islamic Republic. We're going to install something that looks like the Taliban. And within 6 months to a year, Egypt is going to look just like Saudi Arabia or Iran on its worst days. You know, back in the 70s. So it's a really tough one. I mean, it's a real tough one. Because we've created such a mess because of the just mind-boggling incompetence of these people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
I hope the days come easy and the moments pass slow. And each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile. But more than anything, more than anything, my wish for you is that this life becomes all that you wanted to. Your dreams stay big, your worries.
There you go. And that this nation become all it can be. Here's our mind-boggling conservative alert for the day. They're at it again. First of all, just for the record, the state of Kansas does, or for that matter, the entire United States does not import natural gas from Russia, Venezuela, or Iran. None. Zero. The entire country. Nowhere in the United States do we import natural gas from Russia, Venezuela, or Iran. Got that? So why is an ad running in Kansas that has a picture of Vladimir Putin, Hugo Chavez, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad with a big headline saying, "Why are these men smiling?" And then underneath that says, "Because the recent decision by the Sebelius administration," that's the governor of Kansas, "means Kansas will import more natural gas from companies like, from countries like Russia, Venezuela, and Iran." Well, it turns out what happened is the Kansas Department of Health and Environment said that two 700-megawatt coal-burning power plants could not be built. They denied them air quality permits. They said that they cited health and environmental concerns associated with carbon dioxide emissions. This is the first time, by the way, a coal plant permit application has ever been denied on the basis of CO2 emissions. So this ad is running with pictures with, comparing the governor to Putin, Chavez, and Ahmadinejad, and claiming that because they can't have this coal-fired power plant, that Kansas is going to have to import natural gas from these three guys, when in fact no one in the United States imports natural gas from any of these three guys. And it turns out, guess who's paying for the ad? It's called Kansans for Affordable Energy, right? Yeah, right. It's partially funded by the Sunflower Electric Power Company and Peabody Coal. Sunflower Electric, by the way, is the company whose permits were rejected by the Sebelius administration. This is filthy. This is just filthy. And expect to see a lot more of it as we go into the campaign, because when conservatives cannot win on the issues. They simply cannot win on the issues, and so they have to resort to character assassination and personal attacks. And there's going to be more of it. There's going to be a lot more of it coming. Scott in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I want to say I like Dennis Kucinich, but I was watching that thing yesterday, and when they pulled that scam on him, it would have made Tom DeLay proud. He looked like a deer in headlights. Every Republican voted with him to not table it, not send it to committee. The Republicans all voted to have an hour debate yesterday and then vote whether to impeach him. And thank God Hoyer was there to get it into committee, or the Democrat Party today would have been in disarray, and I'll tell you, it would improve the Republicans' chances of getting the White House next year.
Well, I think that's what the Republicans want the Democrats to think, Scott.
Well, no,
but I don't think that's true.
Well, let me ask you then. Every one of them voted to do it. All they needed was, if they had, you heard what he told you, they could have impeached him yesterday. All they needed was 70 Democrats to vote with him.
I know. Actually, I don't think that they could have impeached him yesterday, because there would have had to have been some, at least some hearings, and there would have had to have been a vote.
No, they voted not to send it to committee. An hour debate. Nope.
I know. No, I agree. And I believe, and maybe I'm wrong on this, and maybe you're right, Scott. Maybe Steny Hoyer is right, that it will harm the Democrats if there are hearings about the impeachment, about the crimes of the Cheney administration. But I believe that the Republicans are convinced that it would be extraordinarily damaging and destructive to them to have real impeachment hearings where the real crimes of this administration are laid out.
Well, see, that's
and as a consequence of that, they're trying to cause the Democrats to believe that it would be harmful to the Democrats. And that's why I said it's like the Brer Rabbit thing. You know, please don't throw me in that briar patch, because that's exactly what he wanted.
So you think that every Republican was wrong yesterday, and every Democrat was wrong, and you and Dennis Kucinich are the only two that were right, that this would hurt the Democratic Party?
I'm not tracking your question here.
Every Democrat did not want that to come to a vote yesterday, and every Republican did. But you and Dennis Kucinich said we could have voted yesterday, and he was mad about that.
Well, you know, again, as I said, I don't think that a vote would have happened yesterday. I think that the hearing process could have begun yesterday, though. I think that the Democrats are wrong. The Democrats, the political calculus inside the Beltway is that it's going to harm the Democratic Party to have a public airing of the crimes of Dick Cheney.
Tom,
and I think that the Democratic Party is wrong on that.
Tom, once they voted yesterday not to send it to committee, there are no hearings. All they had to do was debate and vote. They voted not to have hearings is what the vote basically was. And then thank God Hoyer was there, because he said, no, we got to send it to committee, and he got enough votes to do that.
Yeah, okay, you're right. And so the point of that is that the thing at least stayed alive because it's in committee, and now there actually might be hearings. Is that your point, Scott?
I think so, but I'm telling you, his one thing about getting them when they're out of office is good. If you would have saw him on the floor yesterday, he looked like a deer in headlights. He was like, abba, abba. Yeah. And Hoyer was, let me straighten this out here.
Yeah,
and it was a good thing he was there, because he was putting a pretty good spin on it today, but I'm afraid he's going to be the Ralph Nader of 2008.
Well, let's hope not, Scott. But thanks a lot for the call. And interesting. Layers within layers within layers, right? When you're talking about the impeachment of the Vice President of the United States, you're talking about serious stuff. Fascinating. You can, by the way, get more information over at Kucinich US, and if you want to call your member of Congress, go to callcongress.org, and there's all the phone numbers right there. It's a website over on our website. 57 minutes past here. Thanks so much for being with us today. Tomorrow, 9/11 Truth Debate, Kevin Ryan and Michael Shermer. It's going to be a hoot. Show up. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.